Welcome back to the American Revolution Podcast, episode 55, Heading North. So, in the last several months, we have discussed several big events. We have just finished talking about Hudson River fortifications and the effect they had on various points of in the war, as particularly along the Hudson River, and examining the types of defenses that were developed by the Continental Congress, private citizens, secret committees, so on and so forth. Before that, we had spent a lot of time talking about Washington and his army. We were talking about how the British have left Boston. They moved to New York. There was battles around New York, in Brooklyn, Kipps Bay, Harlem, White Plains. This is where we had spent the better part of about 6 months, because the last time we were talking about anything going on north of White Plains, I guess, would be not until since last, I guess, Christmas. If I remember my dates properly, I remember I had done something in and around Christmas time where I kind of just wrapped up Canada rather quickly. And so that was kind of where we left off with Canada. But that was over 7 months ago. So now, I thought with this episode, it would be really good if I just took time just to do a review. This is unscripted. I'm not reading off of notes that I take. Anytime I do these episodes, I always take really in-depth notes, make sure I know what points I want to bring up, make sure I have good supporting details available to me. It is, you know, a lot to think about when you're trying to record, and as you're watching the little red line run across the screen, sometimes that can get in your head and get you all caught up. But today I'm kind of doing this, you know, a little ad hoc. So please excuse the uhs and ums, where there will be points where I might be a little bit delayed, where I'm just trying to formulate the idea. But I thought I would go unscripted with the 55th episode, just because I just want to do just an overview. And in the coming weeks, I'm going to start when I start talking about the campaigns prior to the major campaigns of 1777. There's a couple of mini battles that take place and some real good delaying action on the part of the Continental Army, that I just wanted to make sure that everyone remembered who were our key players in the North. And always the best place to start with any story is start from the beginning. And we began talking about the Northern Army when we started talking about the formation of the Continental Army itself. Formed in June of 1775, the Continental Army would be the punching hand of the Continental Congress. They would be the teeth. Because remember, the British have invaded. They are in the city of Boston. Now, the Americans have pushed them back. They attempted to take our powder and munitions at Concord. We pushed them back. They are now locked up in Boston. But it's a militia army. Militia army isn't always it's hard to lead a militia army, because each militia reports to its commander. It's not going to want to listen to some gentleman from another colony like Virginia. So to kind of protect the Continental Congress and the colonies from a bunch of militias just running around doing whatever they wanted, we have George Washington. George Washington is made commander of chief of the new Continental Army. The militias could choose to join the Continental Army. I shouldn't say the militias. I should say men could choose to volunteer for the Continental Army. You could stay in your own militia, but a lot of militiamen joined the Continental Army. But now you're in command of General Washington. Now, you're not going to just give command to just one man. There's a command structure that follows it. And one man can't command all of the locations all over the 13 colonies. He has, you know, he needs support. And the first thing they did was they made four major generals. One of those was Philip Schuyler, a New Yorker. So the fact that we have various commanders from various areas was another good thing. It brought unity to the Continental Army. Now, Philip Schuyler was a man of upstate New York. He is of Dutch descent. He is a man that was a learned man, but not in the ways of war. He was well-versed in the ways of logistics, moving product up and down the Hudson River from his home in and around the Saratoga area. He also had a home in Albany, where he also did some exportation. He sent a lot of supplies and raw materials down to New York City to be shipped out. So he was a man that knew how to operate the rivers. This man would lead an army of about 5,000 from Albany up into Canada. Now, he had a second-in-command, Richard Montgomery. Unfortunately, Philip Schuyler early on would succumb to a fit of gout that he had his whole life, and that gout would put him out of action. He couldn't walk, he could barely ride, so he has to be sent back to Albany. Still in command of the Northern Army, Richard Montgomery will take over as commander of the army. Now, not only do we have 5,000 men being sent up from Albany, we have another few thousand being that were taken away from the army in and around Boston, sent into Maine, or present-day Maine. Maine is still part of the Massachusetts colony, let me just remind you. They're sent to Augusta, to a fort there. From that fort, they head north into Canada themselves. They were going to take a direct route to Quebec, but they would have to go through the Northwoods, a section of Maine that is very densely forested, and it is going to be difficult to traverse. And the rivers there aren't so lined up like they are in upstate New York. There's a lot of portaging. So you can take your boats upriver, but then you're going to have to get out of the boat, unpack, march the boats to the next point, and so on and so forth. Now, this was supposed to take place in September of 1775, but it doesn't take place until later on, almost into October. We are now to October. The man who's leading this expedition is Benedict Arnold. Benedict Arnold will have to have the work of 100 men to get his force up into Canada, into Quebec, and hopefully to join with Schuyler's troops before the worst will happen. Now, Montgomery, in command of the troops in Schuyler's stead, also has a tall order ahead of him, because his route takes him to Montreal, an old city, a pretty well-fortified city. Montreal would be his target. And from there, he would take his men and march to Quebec, where he would rendezvous with Arnold, to which the two armies would lay siege to that city, probably the most fortified city in the British colony of Quebec. But before he can take Montreal, he has to take things like Crown Point, the fort at St. John, the fort at Chambly, and the forts on the Sorrel River. So the British don't just command the city, they command several forts. The hardest nut to crack was going to be Fort St. John, to which Montgomery lays siege to. With the help of some natives in the area and some local French that were their willingness to support the British was, you know, very questionable, because they themselves wanted to be free of the lordship of the British Army. About 1,000 or so French-Canadian militia will join Montgomery. And it's through this French-Canadian militia and some local natives that were also allied to the French-Canadians that they would learn that Fort Chambly was a fort that could be taken by a modest amount of men. You see, the fort itself was a fort that was to protect against Indian attacks, so the walls were thin. Even the light artillery that the Americans possessed at the time would be enough to penetrate the walls. And so they do. They fire a few shots into the wall. The British strike the colors. They know they can't hold up because it's just a matter of a few more cannonballs, and one section of the wall comes down and insurge the French Canadians and the Americans. So Fort Chambly is taken pretty well. Now, Fort St. John was still well fortified. It was reinforced by a lot of the men from Montreal. Montgomery still has to think about how he's going to crack this nut. well, the best thing to do is to cut off any kind of support that they could get. And to do that, he would take control of the Richelieu and Sorel rivers and any kind of forts or fortified areas that the British possessed along those rivers. And so he takes those as well, eventually chipping away at the defenses in and around Montreal City. When Fort St. John falls, and the 300 to 400 men that were garrisoned inside Fort St. John were overtaken, Montreal has nothing to do but to seek terms. Now, the man opposing the American forces is Sir Guy Carleton, also the man who would be the royal governor of Canada at the time. Not only is he the military commander, but he's also the royal governor. Well, Guy Carleton, once Fort St. John fell, ran off, leaving the French Canadians in the city to suddenly say, well, we're without any British here. The British commander has left. So we're willing to work with you. And so Richard Montgomery strikes terms, and Montreal falls without firing a shot. So with Montreal in hand, he has suffered some losses, but he still has about 4,000 effectives that he can move to head to Quebec. The problem is that when Montreal fell, it's November, and the snow is starting to fall. Now, where is Sir Guy Carleton? Well, Sir Guy Carleton went upriver. He's going to head to Quebec because Quebec is the next bastion of hope for the British Army in Canada. It's also on a bay. Whereas Montreal is on the river, Quebec is on a bay. Now, at this point in the year, the bay starts to freeze. He's not going to get any help from Britain, so he has to bunker down and hold out in a siege. So when Guy Carleton makes it to Quebec, he only has a few hundred British to call upon. He has to call upon the local militia, and he gets as many men as he possibly can. He has about 1,000. Which is actually a fair number. Well, there was one thing that Carleton did that was actually kind of ingenious. You see, as soon as he gets to the city, he actually had to run the beginning of the siege. You see, by this point in November of 1775, Benedict Arnold made it through the Maine wilderness. When he started out with about 3,000, where he started out with just under 3,000 men. Losses along the way, by the time he gets to Quebec, he has somewhere around 1,000 men. And they were sickly. Any others that survived the trip were considered ineffective. It meant that they had contracted smallpox. There was the fact that they were dealing with the cold. Some of them were dealing with hypothermia conditions. All in all, it just wasn't a great trip. Arnold himself was a little feverish during this. It's when the Americans got there, the local Canadians said they were more an army of ghosts than an army of men. But needless to say, they got there. They started to lay siege to the city. But the problem was they had very small artillery, and the guns of the city outranged his, so he had to sit back at a far distance. So when Guy Carleton actually runs past the siege, he gets into the city and realizes, well, we have the beginnings of a siege here. I need to make sure that the city is safe. So what does he do? He takes out any men that wouldn't join the local militia. Him and their family were forced to leave. So if you didn't join the local militia, you had to leave. This way, he would get, in his idea, only men that were loyal to the crown. It's actually kind of an ingenious idea. You actually take away any possibility that you could have an uprising in the city while the siege is going on. So, but you also are sending Canadians that weren't actually loyal to the crown to the Americans, where they can be put into the rotation there. And that's what they do. Once Montreal had fallen, Montgomery marched his men up to Quebec. He has to man all the forts. He has to protect Montreal. So by the time he gets to Quebec and to the siege, he only has about 500 to 1,000 men available to him after manning all the protected positions behind him. And when he gets there, and Arnold's force is, you know, worn down as well because their trip was disastrous, he only has about 500 men available, 1,500 men available to him. So he is, his numbers are not so different from what Guy Carleton has inside the city. But he begins to lay siege as well. The problem was his guns were also outranged by the city's guns. He doesn't have anything big enough to knock down the walls. And they're firing at him. Well, what's stopping them from taking out their guns? There's no way to build up kind of any earthen works or to do what you would normally do in a siege and dig trenches going towards the city so you could bring the guns in real close. It's right now the very beginning of December, or the very end of November into December, and the ground is frozen solid. It's ice. It's snow. So Montgomery has to devise a way to protect his guns and get them a little bit closer so that he could hopefully do some damage to the city. This is where he is very ingenious. What he does is he gets A. He builds protection around the guns in the cover of night. And then what he does is he takes water from the river and soaks it. He takes snow and water and soaks the hay. They turn into solid ice walls. They were nicknamed the Ice Battery. And it was genius. But the problem is the guns still aren't powerful enough to break down the walls of Quebec. The walls of Quebec are much thicker than they are in Montreal or even at Chambly. These weren't forts that were outposts to protect against Indians. This was a walled, fortified city. It was a key city for the French, and it was one that was taken by the blood of a lot of British soldiers in the war, in the French and Indian War. So now Montgomery has to do the impossible with 1,500 men, or so he thinks. Because he's going to lose about 500 of those men to enlistments expiring at the 1st of December. So now he has a bigger problem. The men who were fighting with him saw their enlistments were expiring and left, not including those who were just deserting on their own. So he just lost a huge chunk of his mobile army because they up and left. So what does he do now? He's got about 1,000 men. So Montgomery now has to make a decision. And because it's now, we have now surpassed Christmas, and we're now about to turn into 1776. We're just about at New Year's. And when that happens, he's going to lose a large percentage of his fighting force because enlistments will expire on January 1st. Sorry. And that's going to take away almost half of the effective fighting force in Canada. So Montgomery makes a daring move. Under cover of night, on New Year's Eve, he marches into battle. He sends the supporting French-Canadian militias to kind of feint the other side of the city and kind of just draw their attention away. He and Arnold will take two spurs of the army, and they'll march in opposite directions to meet at St. John's Gate. One will go one way along the river, the other one will circumnavigate through the lower town and try and hit St. John's Gate from there. Arnold goes through the lower town, and the Canadians and British had built barricades. Well, they get over the first one all right. The second one is a little bit of a challenge, and they actually start having a street fight with some French-Canadian militia. Well, the loyal French-Canadians, I should say, are having it out with Arnold and his force. Well, he's almost over the second barricade, and he's going to lead his men by example. He had a bad habit of doing so, and he was the first one in. Well, unfortunately, he gets shot in the leg and has to be pulled out of the action. He has to be pulled away on a stretcher because he can't walk. So the command of the force falls to Daniel Morgan, a Virginian rifleman that we're going to talk about a lot more when we come into other battles in the American Revolution. But here he really earns his stripes and takes the men over the second barricade, and he actually almost gets to the St. John's Gate. But where's Montgomery and his men? While Montgomery's men were moving along the river and they were about to charge the gate when they came across a bunkhouse. In that bunkhouse, there was a 3-pound gun. That 3-pound gun unleashed grapeshot into the attacking troops. Richard Montgomery is shot and killed. His body is saved and dragged away by a young man who survives the grapeshot, who was running very close to him. That's a young Aaron Burr. Yes, the man who will shoot Alexander Hamilton in just a couple of decades will be the man that carries his commander away from the battlefield. So Montgomery, his second in command, decides that they're going to pull out. So that leaves Morgan to fight it out on his own. And they actually almost took the gate, but they're forced to retreat, except Morgan and some of his men are cut off. So as the two spurs retreat, Morgan is presented by or is approached by the British, and they say, "Surrender. You're not going to survive this." Well, Morgan looks into the crowd of troops around him, and he sees a priest, a Catholic priest, mind you. And he looks at the Catholic priest and says, "I'll only surrender to you because you're the only one I respect." Man, the man was brazen, but you got to respect him. Needless to say, Morgan and his men surrender. The Canadians, who were supposed to create a feint at the other side of the city, they did it, and they did it to the best of their ability, except the British saw right through it, and they knew that they were attacking the gate on the other side of the city, so they moved all their men to protect the gate. So the attack was, you know, doomed from the beginning. And as the next day turned into the first of the year, well, unfortunately, those enlistments still went up and men left. Arnold is brought back to Montreal injured. They're still laying siege to Quebec, mind you. They're still trying to lay siege to Quebec because they're hoping that they'll capitulate, but most of their fighting force is gone. With Montgomery dead and Benedict Arnold now laid up in the hospital, the next man that would be in charge is David Wooster, a man of Massachusetts. He's not a great commander. And what he starts to do, he starts to consolidate his powers in and around each of the zones of protection. But he's not doing anything to try and better the situation. He's not reorganizing men. So the men that were at Quebec stay at Quebec. And so he stays in Montreal and is actually just kind of running things in and around the Montreal area and is kind of ignoring what's going on at Quebec. And this goes on for over a month. We get to February and Arnold starts to feel a little bit better, but he's writing Congress saying, "I can't walk. I am injured. Wooster isn't doing his job. Send me someone to help." And so Philadelphia decides that they're going to send Charles Lee. But as we talked about in an episode after finishing up at Canada, we were headed south for a little bit. Charles Lee had to head south to Charleston, South Carolina, because the British made another attempt there. So the Americans are pretty much on their own for months. And it's not getting any colder. It's actually starting to warm up. Pretty soon, by April, there's going to be no chance fresh British warships are going to show up into Quebec. David Wooster still hasn't done anything, and he is not taking account that what's going on at Quebec is there is a siege that isn't effective at all. He needs to try and get help from somewhere. Word finally gets to Washington what's going on, and he's still in Boston. And the siege of Boston is going really well, and it's at the very end of February, beginning of March, he sends Brigadier General Jonathan Thomas, sends him north with 14 regiments, over 5,000 men he sends north to assist with operations up there. Thomas gets there ahead of the army. Well, he gets to Albany, starts organizing things at then he moves up to Ticonderoga, starts sorting things out there. As the 14 regiments pass him and start heading into Quebec, he'll show up in and around April. Well, the only problem is, at this point, it's useless. The first British ships are starting to arrive. they're unloading thousands of redcoats. The Americans had their opportunity, but the problem was word never got to Washington fast enough. If I was Wooster, I would have been sending word to Washington in January. Montgomery is dead. Schuyler is out with injury. I'm in command of Montreal. I need troops. But instead, he waits until the end of February. And he can't, and Washington can't send men at the drop of a hat. He has to organize those men. And then those men have to march hundreds of miles. They don't get there until the middle of March. And by that point, it's useless because the army is already beginning to consolidate itself and pull back from its exterior positions. The siege at Quebec was broken by the middle of March. Montreal has to be abandoned by April. So all the forts are lost. The Americans now have to pull back to Crown Point, the last major fortified position they would have in, at the top of New York's colony. Just before, that's kind of where the border between Canada and the New York colony would be roughly etched out. So it's there that the Americans consolidate their forces. Luckily, by April, Arnold has pretty much recovered, from his leg injury. And he's able to walk, he's able to move around, he's able to take command of the troops. And that's where we kind of left off our story. Arnold is in Crown Point. Now what's going to happen next? And that's where we're going to pick up our story in about a week and a half. I really have to say this is the one good thing I will say is this week marks the 2-year anniversary of when I started this project. Unfortunately, life gets in the way, and with a ever-changing group of jobs that I have been, it's being a teacher is definitely a great profession. It's also one that sees the scenery change quite a bit sometimes. And over the last 2 years, I've changed my job from working in New York to working in Delaware, and changing my job even there from working in a classroom setting to working in the special education setting. So it is a it's been a bumpy road. And the fact that I only have 55 episodes out in 2 years is a little upsetting, but it is good that I'm averaging 2 episodes a week. I hope to increase that. Things do happen. There was some points where there were long expanses of time where I was out. My grandmother had passed away. There were some problems at home, things of various nature, and everyone was understanding. And that was one thing I'm very happy about, that those who started listening in the, when I started it 2 years ago, have stuck it out this long and have helped spread the word to more. I'm getting hundreds of downloads a week now. I just am very thankful for the support of all the listeners out there. So this episode will be kind of where we end it for about 2 weeks. In the summertime, my schedule is a little more fluid. I know that's one a pet peeve for some people is that I never have an exact date, and I always bounce around. I try and do it at the beginning of the week, the end of the week. Weekends are impossible with working two jobs. I work a lot on the weekends. So I always try to do it on nights where I am off, and that happens sometimes at the beginning of the week, sometimes at the end of the week. So it's kind of hard to gauge that, and I do apologize for having a very fluid schedule where it goes all over the place, and I thank everyone for being very understanding with that. It's really helpful. But I plan to come back in about a week and a half. And we are going to start talking about the campaign and the Battle of Valcour Island. So that will do it for the podcast. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And Wednesday is the 4th of July. Find something near you that is hopefully related to the American Revolution. If you live in other parts of the country that were not in original 13 colonies, then see something else. As you venture to the Midwest, you see a lot of Civil War battlefields. you know, as you go farther out west, you know, there's a lot of sites for the Indian Wars and the like. Like, just take time to appreciate the history of America this week. And it's really something that's rewarding. As for myself, I have family coming in, so I won't be doing any kind of events with the 1st Delaware Regiment. But they do have a event at Bethany Beach in Delaware. We do a parade down there. Unfortunately, I won't be there this year, but it is a lot of fun. It is a hot one, having done it one year myself. But yeah, just take some time. Appreciate the history of America this week, because Wednesday is the 4th of July. And if you're in a state that's legal, like Delaware, it is legal to possess fireworks. Exercise your American right. Shoot off some fireworks. It is a heck of a lot of fun. And on that note, I wish everyone a happy and safe 4th of July. And as always, especially this week, keep those fireworks dry.